the devil's advocates. Sausage making never looked so good.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Thursday edition. It's getting better. Right now, I'm joined live via phone by a fine guest. He is John Nichols from The Nation. John, welcome back to the big show.
Good to be with you, brother.
John, so good. I'm always happy when you answer the call, man. John, I took note of an article. You actually shared it with me. I told you I was in the car. I hadn't done my prepping yet, but I've done the prepping. John, I've read the article. You assert that Marjorie Taylor Greene, congresswoman from the state of Georgia, should be blocked from the ballot predicated on the 14th Amendment. Well, John, we talked quite a bit about that public testimony she gave last Friday. Do you think it was convincing, the presentation made by, you know, I guess the opponents of Marjorie Taylor Greene? Do you think she will be banned? Do you think she should be banned? I think I know, but share with the audience, John.
You got about 18 questions on the table there, my friend. First and foremost, did I see the testimony? Yes, of course I did. It was comic, right?
It was.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has never, ever forgotten a single mean-spirited, destructive, awful idea that has come into her head, right? She spouts it constantly. Never forgets to attack Ilhan Omar or AOC or Mark Pocan or anybody else, right? Somehow she forgot every single thing that she did from like about November 3rd, 2020 until, you know, January 20th, 2021. Complete memory block, nothing there. And so, of course, her testimony was absurd. It was a lie. Because when you say you don't remember something that you clearly remember, you're lying. And she lied repeatedly and got caught out immediately because, of course, CNN released the text transcript with her text to Mark Meadows, which revealed that she was actively involved in plotting a coup. And then when the initial coup attempt failed, the invasion and occupation of the Capitol, attempt to overthrow the results of a legitimate presidential election, then she proposed, or at least threw up the idea of martial law. Now, admittedly, she couldn't spell the word martial as in martial law, but she still tried. And so what you've got is somebody who, you know, is guilty as charged. There's simply no question. She meets the standard of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, which says that if you are an insurrectionist, i.e. someone who is involved in plotting a coup, or if you give aid and comfort to insurrectionists, which she did when she voted to implement the agenda of the coup plotters, which was to overturn the results from Arizona and Pennsylvania. She did so on the night of January 6th, after five people had died and more than 100 police officers had been injured by the insurrectionists who attacked the Capitol. So she's full-on guilty. There's no question of that. She's guilty. She meets the standard on all levels. Now you ask the question, what will the judge do? You know, will this judge do the right thing and issue a memorandum that effectively says she's in violation of 14th Amendment, Section 3? I think there's a possibility. The judge has at least entertained these issues. The lawyers who are involved are exceptionally talented, very, very good lawyers. They have asked late to update their submissions to strengthen them even more. And so I think there's a reasonably good argument. Then you get to the bigger challenge, which is, does Brad Raffensperger have the courage to actually do the right thing when he is involved in a Republican primary that will decide whether he keeps his job? I don't have a lot of confidence in Raffensperger. He stood up to Trump at one point. I thought that was good. Not sure that he'll do this in a primary setting. So it's up for grabs. But frankly, if the judge signals that you've got a congressperson who is in violation of the 14th Amendment and thus disqualified from running for reelection, from being on the November ballot, that's an issue you can continue to litigate and advocate on, and it also sends a signal for the rest of the country. So I think the Greene case is a huge deal. It's relevant even for Wisconsin because we have a similar lawsuit in Wisconsin targeting Ron Johnson, Tom Tiffany, and Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, I'm well aware. Let me tell you, John, I was... I'd hate to say it, but I was a little boonswoggled by the defense Marjorie Taylor Greene's attorney James Bopp offered. And the only part that was convincing to me, because obviously she was lying and didn't recall anything else.
Totally,
but when prompted by her counsel, she effectively discussed a live stream and the fact that she was, quote unquote, a victim of the insurrection. And she, unlike the president, asked people to go home and be safe and all that kind of stuff. But John, subsequent to that testimony, then I've seen the text messages to Mark Meadows that happened January 17th of 2021.
After.
Yeah, and John, that's exactly when she's discussing, you know, although misspelling, martial law, and saying, you know, we know it was stolen. I mean, this was truly a
Our only hope is martial law.
It was truly one more Hail Mary. Does that newfound evidence, I don't know if it was presented at the administrative court trial. They didn't really have the chance to do full discovery. Now, do you think that should be included in the decision-making process? I certainly think it's persuasive against Marjorie Taylor Greene.
So first and foremost, the issue was raised. She was asked whether she had advocated for martial law to be declared. It's one of the many things she said she didn't
remember. I can't recall.
Now I just want to tell you something. I've covered Congress for a little bit. I know politicians a little bit about them. My sense is that you don't forget when you actually are calling for overthrowing the government. That usually sticks in your mind, right? So I think she was lying about that, first and foremost. But at this very fundamental level, the deeper level, is that, there's evidence that well after their supposed argument of mitigation, which was an argument that, you know, she was scared on January 6th, which she may well have been. And coup plotters often get scared in the middle of a coup attempt, right? That's not unheard of. Sometimes coup plotters even try to cover up their involvement in a coup attempt, as we have seen historically from places around the world. So her argument was she was scared on January 6th. Well, she wasn't so scared that 11 days later, she was advocating for the president of the United States to at least consider using the military to block the peaceful transition of power. That's what martial law is. And effectively, to implement a much deeper coup, a more profound coup than what was attempted on January 6th. So she's guiltier of being an insurrectionist than was fully revealed in the initial testimony and pleadings. So yes, Free Speech for People and the other groups, the other lawyers that are involved here, should be able to update their claims to bring this additional evidence to the judge's attention. And, I do think it makes a very conclusive case. The one final thing I'll say is don't ever be, you know, like hornswaddled by Attorney Bopp. He's one of the biggest right-wing hacks in the game. You know, I mean, he isn't like some, you know, like savvy country lawyer.
No, I wasn't. You know, fooled by his courtroom savvy. It was, I just thought that might be the thing that released the pressure and got her off the hook effectively. Folks, you're listening to
It's one of those things you're thrown out to try and get the judge to give the judge something to hang on to if he were to throw the case out.
Yes, sir. Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Got a fine guest. He is John Nichols from The Nation. And if you haven't seen the newest article from John on Marjorie Taylor Greene, we posted it up at the Devil's Advocates Facebook page. You know, it's quite ironic, though. Marjorie Taylor Greene gave testimony last Friday, and she's directly contradicted by her text to Mark Meadows. And now that's in the public, public view. And I think it was Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, Republican leader in the House, came out and basically denied that he ever asked Trump to resign. It was directly contradicted like within 24 hours, John. And above and beyond that, he specifically went out against and named names in the caucus. I think it was Gozar and Gates, and said, these guys are dangerous. They're actually putting their own caucus member, Liz Cheney, in danger by directing these false attacks upon her. John, have you ever seen, people expose so quickly to public ridicule and obviously their own duplicitous cowardice natures.
Yeah, occasionally. Remember, certainly not cowardice. Kevin McCarthy's the king of cowardice. But yeah, you've seen the occasional politician. You remember James Stockdale, who was Perot's running mate, and you know appeared in the vice presidential debate and seemed his first question was, who am I? Why am I here? And so you occasionally see politicians who are very quickly revealed as being kind of not up for the moment. But you do bring in this issue of cowardice, right? And that's the big deal with Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is such a bombastic figure. She is such a cool and unusual player, right? That, you know, one would think that she's pretty firm in her convictions, right? You know, she at least, you know, kind of believes what she's saying. What was revealed by this trial is that that's not the case, right? She's not addled or confused. She knows who she is. She's very strategic. And yet when it comes to a question of where does she stand on the things she has said and she has done, when she faces the possibility of losing her congressional paycheck and losing her platform from which to speak, suddenly her memory is blanked out. She's less aware. She's less conscious than anybody else in politics. And, you know, that's just pure cowardice. She's lying in order to protect herself.
John Nichols, my fine guest. John, wanted to turn you back a little bit towards our backyard. I'm now calling her Big Lie Becky Clayfish. Rebecca Clayfish, the gubernatorial frontrunner, although one must question if she's afraid of Tim Michaels' entry into the race. He is the businessman, perhaps billionaire in the making, self-made by his own assessment. But anyways, she...
Self-made the same way Ron Johnson is.
Yeah, yeah. But Rebecca Clayfish effectively came out and said 2020 sure feels like a rigged election. And then she said, you know, lots of things that Gableman's looking at and things, and I hope he finds some things. You know, very eloquent in her presentation of her things yesterday, John. But this was, I think, a sign of the fear of her and her campaign of Tim Michaels' entry into the race. But above beyond that, John, this is a full tact to fiction. I mean, she is now running the Rantham campaign platform.
Yeah, she's terrified, right? She's terrified by the fact that she's going to be outflanked on the right, which was not a problem for her when she got into politics. You know, initially, Rebecca Clayfish was sort of the defining figure on the right wing of Wisconsin politics. But in those days, the fight was defined not by a fight over whether the 2020 election was legitimate, which it was. It was defined by issues such as abortion rights, gay rights, stuff like that. And on those issues, she staked out a very far-right, social right-wing position.
Sure.
What she's now finding out is that the Republican Party is not so focused on those things anymore. I mean, certainly those are big issues for the GOP, there's no doubt. But that they've got sort of a new mantra, and this new mantra is this authoritarian, anti-small-D Democratic, hardcore pressure to dismantle, in many senses, Wisconsin democracy and to undermine the... Anthem's got the territory claimed, right? He's the man. He took on Robin Voss, who is a, you know, sort of unannounced supporter of Rebecca Clayfish for governor. And so clearly stick up the turf. Clayfish is now trying to, you know, move into that ground. There's a reason for that, because Kevin Nicholson and Tim Michaels, these candidates are going, they're very right wing to that, and they'll mouth some of the Trump cliches, but they're much more presenting themselves as sort of classic, you know, Republican conservative business types, especially Michaels. And so Clayfish has lost some of her territory. She's got to get the nuts, right? She needs the extremists to make it through this primary. And that's why she's pivoting toward the Rantham turf. But it isn't going to work. I mean, a Rantham backer isn't going to look at somebody who's supported by Robin Voss, who in the Marquette University poll turns out to be like the least popular person in Wisconsin.
John, hold that thought. More Devil's Advocates. My fine guest, John Nichols from The Nation. We'll be right back.
the devil's advocates, the fix for political junkies everywhere.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Thursday edition. I got a fine guest live via phone. He is John Nichols from The Nation. John, appreciate you sticking around, man. I don't know if you've been listening to the radio locally here in the Madison media market, but I already hear that Rebecca Clayfish and this new entry to the Republican field of, you know, governor wannabes, Tim Michaels, man, the right-wing talk radio airwaves, they're already filthy with ads. And my TV set's starting to get filthy as well. Now, Alex Lazary, he's running for the U.S. Senate seat. He's got lots of ads running as well. I think Godlewski has joined him of late on the airwaves. But, John, like half the voters, both the Republican gubernatorial race and the Democratic senatorial race, the hope to, you know, beat Ron Johnson, I mean, like half the voters on both sides are undecided. John, we're only like 3 years away from primary, three months away from primary day. That seems strange. Shouldn't there be more preference shown at this late hour?
Yeah, up to a point. These are races, obviously, open on each side. You don't have an incumbent in the Democratic primary or in the Republican primary, Democratic primary for governor. So in that case, you do have a it's coming forward, none of whom is a absolute locked-in front runner. But, there is a lot of kind of fluidity in these races. And I think the interesting thing is that in the Republican governor's race, it's fluid because people keep getting into it, right? I mean, you thought for a long time your race was going to be Clayfish versus Nicholson. It's clear Nicholson wanted to run it. Nicholson just wanted to run for something. If the Senate race had come open, he would have done that. But he was going to run for something, and so it became clear it was going to be the governor's race. But now you've got Rantham in there, sort of like, you know, the most extreme. You got Tim Michaels coming in with, I think, quite a bit of establishment support, but it's a different kind of establishment. It's not the Robin Boss inside the Capitol types. It's the money people, right? Yeah. Even folks like Diane Hendricks.
The haves and the have-mores.
And they have, like, a whole lump of lot. So Michael is coming in as a very interesting addition. He is somebody kind of wedged into this race, I think, because a lot of establishment types looked at Clayfish and Nicholson and even, you know, obviously Rantham, you know, a little bit, and determined that these people can't do it. They're not viable. They're not logical candidates, not logical nominees. And so they found somebody else, an ambitious guy who once ran against Russ Feingold. That's telling me that race really is fluid. And obviously, Michaels, he wasn't polled in the Marquette poll, so we don't know where he would register. And I don't think he would have registered very high initially. But by the time the next Marquette poll comes, I suspect there's a chance he will be, you know, very, very prominent in that poll. I don't necessarily know he'd be the front runner, but I think he'll be a serious player. And he could well be the nominee. Now, over on the Democratic side, there's something very interesting happening there. The polls that we had, you know, certainly late last year, early into this year, I think tended to be name recognition polls, right? You were literally, who do you know? And obviously, as you point out, there's a lot of folks who don't know any of these candidates. Beyond that, there's sort of a lot of folks who are, you know, kind of up for grabs. Mandela Barnes really benefited initially because he was better known. He had, you know, run statewide and people had, a lot of Democrats had worked very, very hard for the Evers-Barnes ticket in 2018. Mandela Barnes has maintained a lot of presence around the state. And so I think, you know, he had very good numbers. But now that you've seen Alex Lazary put $4.4 million into an ad campaign in a matter of a few months, Lazary's effectively closed that gap. And so Barnes lost some support. Lazary bumped up significantly. They're now within 3 points in a poll that has a 6.6% margin of error. So effectively, they could be tied. There's a reasonable argument there. But the interesting twist on this is that the person who had the biggest bump up in the poll was Godlewski. And she went up 4 points in this poll after having done a much smaller buy than Lazary. And so I think you have to keep an eye on her. If she increases her spending, increases her campaigning, I think she is I think it's fair to say she's still very much in the race and has, you know, like a lot of potential territory that she could make up. And finally, it was interesting to me that the fourth candidate in that sort of upper tier of the race, and that's Tom Nelson, he stayed even. He was five before, he's five now. Obviously, he would have liked to have bumped up. There's no question of that. But, you know, Nelson's running a very different kind of campaign. He is never going to be the TV candidate. But he is continues to secure pretty significant endorsements. In fact, just today he got the endorsement of Our Wisconsin Revolution, which is the Bernie Sanders group. He's got the Sunrise folks. He's got Western District of United Electrical, which is a good historic old union with, frankly, a lot of retirees in the Milwaukee area. So he's starting to piece together a little bit of that sort of grassroots campaign. I don't know that that'll be sufficient to, you know, begin to, you know, meet the challenge of all the TV advertising. But what I would suggest to you is that you put all these pieces together, I think we've got a very open U.S. Senate race with clearly four candidates who have the potential to make a lot of movement in this race. I do still think, by the way, final thing, that Barnes continues to be the front runner. I think that continues to be the reality. And when he goes up on air, that could well bump his numbers back up. But I don't think that this race is anywhere near settled at this point.
John Nichols, my fine guest for about two more minutes. John, Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post has written extensively about this U.S. Senate race and the Democratic field. And she at one point embraced Tom Nelson's candidacy. She said some nice things about Godlewski. And I would point out, John, she seemingly takes the attitude anybody but Mandela. And you know, perhaps she's an outsider. She doesn't know the lieutenant governor like we do. But, John, she seemingly wants to set up a contrast with Ron Johnson, and she's afraid that Mandela's a little too liberal. Could you see validity to her opinion?
No, I do not. I think that's a wrongheaded opinion of an outsider who doesn't really know much about the state. Whether you like Mandela Barnes or not, whether he's your choice or not, he has won a Democratic primary statewide. He's a player on a Democratic ticket in 2018. And he's frankly maintained a lot of presence outstate as somebody who, you know, shows up at farms, visits every county. I think he is in many ways a very classic contender for a U.S. Senate seat. And I think people that don't see that kind of miss something. However, what I will add, the final element, is that I also think that Godlewski's got a similar claim, right? She comes from Eau Claire. She has been around the state a lot. She's an enthusiastic campaigner. And so I think this idea of, you know, like trying to have people from Washington, D.C. try and pick the candidates for the U.S. Senate race, I think is pretty silly. And bottom line is, too, you know, I don't want to kind of say something nice about everybody, but yesterday I happened to be at events with both Tom Nelson and Alex Lazary. And both of them are showing more and more strength, as campaigners. And frankly,
John, so sorry, man. John Nichols from The Nation. We're out of time. More Devils. Come back.